back to The Fire Break. I'm Steve Wolf. The Fire Break is sponsored by Team Wildfire, developing new techniques and technology to reduce the impact of destructive wildfires. Joining me today, the amazing Brandon Rigaud. Rigaud, that's French, is that right, Brandon?
Yeah, that's right.
All right. So Brandon is a battalion chief in Grand Pass, Oregon. For those of you who know Oregon, it's right where Grand Pass is. He also worked for a company that does software called First Do that I believe is an end-to-end solution of problem-solving stuff for fire departments, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, kind of end-to-end suite for running a fire department's daily operations and reporting and kind of all the other components you need to run a fire department.
Interesting. How long have you been with the department?
So I've worked with the City of Grants Pass for 12 years. And prior to that, I worked for the U.S. Forest Service for 7 years.
Okay. So did that experience with the Forest Service and then coming into the fire department give you, you know, like a bias towards, you know, wildfire as a primary interest?
Yeah. So, you know, coming from, I worked in Region 5 in California for the Forest Service. And when I started looking to test at fire departments, one of the, you know, the selling points, the differentiators, I think, for me was having the wildland fire experience, having worked on, you know, helitech, shot crews, engines. And so, yeah, definitely coming into the fire department, one of the things they started to leverage me for really quickly was, you know, my experience there for teaching courses and kind of helping streamline the wildland fire program here in Grants Pass.
And how is the program?
Great. Yeah, we've really, you know, since I've got here, kind of we've seen a real change in the environment where we've started to see larger fires with more complexity. And so one of the goals that I had was increasing our awareness on wildland urban interface operations for our fire department, realizing that the fires that we had in the prior decade were not matching or in alignment with our skill set that we need moving forward. So, you know, started really simple with just, you know, training, new equipment, and then we started to get new assets. So we got, you know, new brush trucks. We have a Type 3 coming here really quickly through the Oregon State Fire Marshal Program. And then started to leverage that into more complex drills, training, and they've really paid off over the last few years. We've had, an increase in the complexity of the incidents that we've had. And that training has really paid dividends. We responded on, you know, several strike teams to what we were on Almeida, which was a large catastrophic fire just south of here. You know, last year we had several vegetation fires of, you know, 10 acres or greater that had an urban interface component. So the program really has, I think, been really successful. You know, and obviously we had a lot of buy-in from a lot of the stakeholders and cooperators that we work with.
So with the training that you found to be effective, you know, what are some of the aspects of the training that benefited you and that you think would benefit other departments?
Yeah, well, we've really focused on, you know, like I said, on structure protection as a primary component. So we have a really good working relationship with Oregon Department of Forestry, and their primary focus is obviously perimeter control and fire, kind of catch the fire small. However, when that fire encroaches on communities, and our community in particular, one of the things that we get tasked with is, you know, structure triage, protection, and then obviously, you know, point-to-point kind of work. So the training that we've focused on is really how do we get into those homes? How do we quickly triage them? You know, for a fast moving fire, how do we quickly triage, ensuring that we're maintaining our situational awareness and knowing the resources that we have available? So how do we engage with those homes in a way that's systematic, that allows for the greatest potential of saving life and property, and it works best with our cooperators? And so we really focused on those sorts of things. And over the last few years, we've actually had really successful interagency training, or like a spring exercise throughout the Josephine County with all the agencies here, which is really, we've seen a huge increase in our ability to, you know, get apparatus into homes, quickly triage them, deploy hose lines, and then, you know, take those, quickly pull those out, move to the next one, triage them, make an assessment, and kind of do that. Whereas, you know, I'd say 10 years ago, we weren't quite as streamlined in those evolutions.
So when you triage the homes, what are the criteria?
Yeah, well, you know, for structured triage, we're adhering to the standard NWCG principles of structural triage. So, you know, we're always looking for Is the home defensible or non-defensible is kind of a primary component, and what the essentially the go no go kind of prep checklist is. And so, is there vegetation close to the home? Is the home, does it have a wood shake roof? Is it, there's a lot of debris around, hazmat, bridge load limits. So, kind of looking at those, obviously a lot of that work starts prior to a fire. Right. We can talk a little bit more about our kind of FireWise program and where that has kind of helped us. But in the actual component of response, we're kind of looking at those components and deciding, is this home defendable? Is this a non-defendable home? Should we prep and leave, prep and go? And then also do firefront follow us. Is it something where we can do some prep work and then, move our resource to an area that's safer and then go back in after the firefront has passed? As you know, and other guests have talked about, one of the primary ways that homes burn isn't through the firefront actually passing the home. It's actually the small embers and things that catch near the home after the fact. And so if we can get in there and catch those right after the firefront has passed, then we're able to save a lot more homes and spread our resources out a lot more strategically.
So when you get in there to catch those embers, where do you find them hiding?
Yeah, so we always look in kind of the most common places. So like underneath decks, in catches. So like a lot of times we'll see like an attic vent. So we'll see them in there. Roof lines, where roof lines come together. So we'll see them in there. Whatever there's pine debris or, pine or, leaf debris kind of captured, especially on the roof or underneath the side of the house in those areas. And then just in people's stuff, right? People have lawn furniture, wood piles next to the house. So we'll see embers in there. So those are kind of the primary areas we look for. Rain gutters, you'll see them catch in there and whatever debris is kind of in that rain gutter. So we try to catch those pieces first and then kind of go from there.
They get caught in the, outside here, they get caught in the spaces between my gas cans out there.
Yeah. Well, and we see, in Josephine County, which is not unique to us, but in a lot of areas in more rural areas, we see a lot of, people have stuff that they need to sustain themselves. So fuel tanks, water, they'll have water lines and fuel tanks and, debris that's been sitting there for 50 years. And so, we'll capture a lot of those embers in those. And a lot of times they'll catch, say there's an old, vehicle that's being worked on or, is dilapidated. We'll find it in there. The vehicle will catch fire first. And then, the radiant heat will actually catch the house on fire. So that's one of the components that we look at in our structure of triage is, how much yard debris is there? Is stuff movable or not? And, if we need to get back in there, what resources would we need to potentially fight a fire before it got to the home?
So homeowners actually have a lot of influence in your triage process by what they do pre-fire, right? If you show up and there's vehicles around the house and debris and a wood pile right up against the house, like that's going to take a lot of resources for you to mitigate. And that's probably going to move them lower on the triage scale versus a homeowner who takes the time in advance to pre-mitigate their property, with proper firescaping and debris removal, gutter guards, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. Grants Pass is like a lot of communities. We have a really active FireWise program, which provides, we have a FireWise coordinator who goes out and does property assessments, essentially looking at those and providing feedback. And then also can provide guidance on grants for fuel mitigation, hazmat disposal, things of that nature. But that pre-work that homeowners do is pivotal to our operation just because we don't have the resources that other areas do. So we know we have a limited amount of resources to get in there. And if, a home has vegetation right up on the side of the house versus one that doesn't, we're gonna lean towards the one that doesn't because it's where we could probably have the greater likelihood of success versus a home that's going to require, maybe a two or three engines or a hand crew to do some work in there, which we may or may not have access to at that time. That program has been really successful. We have several FireWise communities in Grants Pass, which are just, groups of homes that have essentially committed to doing the work pre-fire.
Yeah.
And then we're able to use those in our, especially in our high wildfire risk areas. We were able to kind of pre-plan those areas, have access and egress maps, water supply laid out, potential, TRAs or temporary refuge areas where we might be able to stage units. So we kind of have those pre-planned already also.
So it sounds like you have a pretty comprehensive program there between engaging the community and a well-organized response effort.
Yeah, that's certainly something we've tried to kind of develop and foster over the last few years is having the community buy-in. Because we've seen fires like Almeda, or in 2016 or 17, we had the Hugo incident, which was just north of Grants Pass, which nearly, you know, took out a sizable chunk of their community. And so I think the community is really bought in on this. Like, if we don't get ahead of this, there may not be much we can do. And if you look at, you know, the 2020 yeah. wildfires across Oregon, they've definitely had a huge impact on, you know, not just us, but the entire state, recognizing that wildfire is here. It's changing. The environment's changing and fires are getting worse for whatever reason. Yeah. And that, you know, people need to be on the leading edge of that, not just expect a fire truck to show up and be able to protect your home.
Yeah, right. And that expectation, I think, you know, is probably responsible for a lot of firefighter injuries. People thinking like, oh, you know, I don't need to be careful, you know, whatever, I'll use my chainsaw, I'll use my lawnmower, I'll, you know, fire up my grill, leave my fire unattended. And if something happens, you know, there's this infinite supply of firefighters that'll just, you know, drop in from Miracleville and they'll take care of it. And well, it's not the case.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I remember, you know, in my really early training in, you know, in California, watching a video about the Oakland Hills fire, which was in the 80s. And someone saying, like, once I saw a fire truck pull around the corner, I knew my house was going to be safe. And I think that that's kind of the romanticized version of what the fire department can do. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's really not the case. We have a limited amount of resources that we can plug in. And so, yeah, them realizing that without, with us just not having those people, and 2020 is a great example. I'll just kind of, you know, out the Almeda incident started in mid-morning in Ashland, which is about 35 minutes, 40 minutes south of here. And high winds, RH, low RH, I mean, all everything was in alignment with the valley. It was just the, kind of the perfect recipe for a fire. And, you know, we have the ability to move strike teams between counties. But realistically, we can leverage, you know, Crispin County and Jackson County. We can get about three strike teams put together and still maintain coverage in our areas. And we, you know, we went down there as part of that. And we kept calling for resources. But every fire in the state was calling for those same resources. And the nearest strike team to us that we were able to get, the next one was from Portland, which is about a 4-hour drive by vehicle. By fire engine, you're probably looking significantly longer. Yeah. And so, yeah, just realizing that those resources aren't there and they're going to take longer to get. And trying to plug our cooperators in also. So, you know, utilize ODF. They don't have the same, you know, training as far as structural protection. You know, they're more wildland focused. But yeah, realizing that we're going to need to do a lot more work on the front side.
Yeah. And for some, for whatever reason, it seems to be harder to attract, you know, the size of the labor pool that's required for mitigation. If you're having to, you know, look for crews coming in from 4 to 6 hours away, you know, that's a pretty scarce resource, especially when you get a big fire and everyone needs that resource. You know, you may not be on the top. So you talked about triaging houses, right? Who's going to get the attention first? When you have a limited number of strike teams and many fires, what's the triage process for delegating the strike teams?
Yeah. So one of the biggest things that I would look at as, you know, as an incident commander is obviously where the fire is now, and where we think the fire is going to go in the next hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, and kind of start forecasting that out. And, you know, really when I'm looking at plugging resources in, I'm looking at where is that fire going to be in the next hour and how long is it going to take to get there? Because if the fire is going to be having overrun a community before we can really get into be successful, we probably need to look at the next group of homes. So we're really looking at kind of fire speed and intensity, looking at the proximity to that and trying to plug those folks into there where it's safe to do so. Also, there's, you know, there's been times where you know, we've been on fires where the fire is going to be in that neighborhood fairly quickly, and we may not be able to get our resources mustered up, put together, and in the community to make, you know, to be effective. So we'll look at the next group of homes and then, or focus on perimeter control. So yep. Last year is a good example of that. We had a fire just north of town off the five. And, there's a lot of values at risk, high school, several kind of, community resources, you know, cisterns, water reservoirs, and then obviously homes. And instead of us trying to go to structure protection, we work directly with our wildland fire partners to do perimeter control. So we actually were able to utilize structural strike teams or task force to come in and assist with perimeter control and keep that fire, you know, to 20 acres and not have anybody plug into the structures at all. Just, you know, realizing that was the best use of our resources is let's try to corral this thing while it's still off on the hill.
Right. You know, one team doing that and one team, right. Let's corral it. That's team one. And if we can't corral it, you know, team two's already worked pre-mitigating.
And a lot of that stuff too is done pre-incident for us on the suppression side. That's situational awareness gathering in the morning. You know, what are your expected weather conditions, fuel conditions? What is the shift that's off going? So if we're coming on to shift, what was their experience with fire over the last couple of days? And especially July, August, September, you know, we're getting small fires here or there. What was that doing versus what it did yesterday?
Yeah.
And so trying to collect as much information or situational awareness as we can. And there's a lot of tools out there that have been really, you know, beneficial for us through apps like, you know, there's WatchDuty, which has been a really helpful app to a lot of folks because you're seeing live fire information posted from fires throughout maybe your area or the adjoining areas. And so as a battalion chief, I'm able to pay attention. Oh, they had a fire in Jackson County yesterday that, you know, went for 5 acres in the first hour. We have very similar fuel loads. We may expect something similar.
Yeah.
And so trying to just gain as much situational awareness prior to the incident, and that will help us determine where to put those resources at the time of need.
What are some of the other apps that are helpful in predicting fire movement and helping you formulate your plans?
Yeah. So I talked about WatchDuty a little bit. And that one's really awesome. I'll just touch on that too, because that has a lot of, it's very heavily moderated. And so there's people who are, you know, reporters, and they have a system to kind of vet information. And so it's not just anybody putting information in. But a lot of us also use, you know, Facebook groups because it's community oriented. So they're able to, you know, provide pictures real time pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But again, that information is somewhat unvetted. So you have to kind of look at that with a grain of salt. And then, you know, obviously there's a lot of federal and state resource at their level. So fuels conditions through the GAC. Looking at, you know, the SIT report and trying to collect as much of that information as you can prior to the incident.
And what about modeling, you know, the fires here? And you said you're most concerned about, you know, where's it going to be in the next hour? How do you know where it's going to be in the next hour?
Well, most fire departments, especially smaller departments like mine, we don't really have access to fire modeling. So we really lean on our wildland partners for that. So, you know, the Forest Service or ODF to be able to leverage those resources. So a lot of what we do is probably more, a gut feel or based on our experience of, what are we seeing and what do we think how that's going to impact the line. As fires grow and evolve, then we get more and more access to those sorts of things through our partners. But yeah, most of that stuff is not, it's not super high tech yet. And having said that, I think that's an area where if we can get that in the hands of initial attack agencies quicker, that would help substantially. And that would be a huge kind of advantage.
Yeah. What would that take to get it in the hands of the people who need it?
Well, that's a great question. I think obviously communication is key here, right? Is having the gateways or the pathways for me as a user agency to be able to communicate with, the agency that's responsible for that. Going back to, you know, some of the, well, some here, one of the interesting things that like WatchDuty is doing, for instance, is they're able to, when the new incident comes in, they're able to get that. They have relationships with like the Forest Service fire modeling, and they're able to get that information over to them to leverage that. That's not something I may have access to, but if a third party has access to that and then can provide that, that's a situational awareness tool that I can grab really quickly. I know it's been vetted and it went through the right process to get there and be able to, you know, leverage that at real time during the incident.
Yeah.
Other than that, local agency, you know, we have the Forest Service and BLM office here in Grants Pass, for instance, being able to continue to foster those relationships. So you're only a phone call away from their dispatch center to start collecting that. And provide them the right inputs. That's another component is, you know, us understanding the right inputs to give them, you know, fuels, weather, topography, location, all that, having that information at their, so they can plug that into their inputs.
And they rely, it seems strange that they rely on you for that information versus, you know, being able to get that automatically through some type of telemetry or monitoring weather stations or, right?
And some of that some of that does exist, right? They can go to the nearest RAS station and grab some of that data. You know, Latin longs are going to be provided through the incident, through dispatch, especially if aircraft's involved, they're going to have a Latin long already on the dispatch. But yeah, some of that's going to be on the field, you know, in the field kind of components of what are you seeing out there? What are you, you know, what do the fuels look like, you know, fuel height density, just because a lot of the aerials and things like that are not necessarily real time where they can see what the fuels look like and et cetera.
Yeah. So there's a lot of information to be gathered in advance or on a regular basis, right? What's going on? How's the snowpack looking? How is the snowpack looking up there?
Yeah, we've had a really, I think, mild winter. You know, talking to, I remember at the end of, I guess the end of last year, October, November, we had our kind of regional PIO meeting with ODF and the Weather Service, and they kind of anticipated this to be a warmer winter, and it's kind of come to fruition that we've had a lot of rain, but the snow levels have been really high, and that's, you know, created some issues for snowpack. I couldn't tell you the exact percentages that we're at right now, but just anecdotally, I don't see a lot of snow in the hills above us, which usually will tend to lead to more fires, especially later season, as those, you know, the 100,000-hour fuels will be more susceptible to fire sooner.
Yeah, so your rain basically hits the ground and runs off, and that's it. That's today's water ration, you know. But the snowpack is the reservoir that will melt during the year and provide, you know, continuous water to the area.
Well, that, and it prevents the higher elevation fires from occurring sooner, earlier in the year. And those are usually the longer duration, you know, what they used to call project fires. We know where we spend a long amount of time trying to corral these things, which, you know, those have long-term ramifications. They draw resources away from the more urban areas to go to those fires. They're longer duration. So you may have, you know, crews timing out and need additional crews to go in there. And then you look at, you know, Grants Pass, for instance, we're a heavy tourism area.
Yeah.
And so when you have a fire, it's in the higher elevation, burning for a long period of time, that smoke gets sucked into the valley. We get an inversion, and that will then start affecting our tourism, start affecting our local economy, you know, because now people, who wants to go visit some place or, you know, be on the river when it's, you know, the air quality is terrible and full of smoke.
It's smoke tourism. Well, you know, they have people who travel around the world and it's like, I want to, you know, check out the sand on every beach, right? I want to breathe the smoke in every wildfire.
There's certainly time of the year. There's certainly years where that may be an advantageous tourism policy, but I don't know if that's how popular that would be.
There's a, you know, a branch of fire science now that's really focusing more on smoke as the agent of ill health more than fire. Right, that many more people's health is impacted by the smoke than by fire directly.
Yeah, that's actually, you know, one of the really interesting things that we're seeing here is, especially as these fires drag further and further into the year, you know, when July, August, you know, June, July, August, school's out, people are, you know, people can leave, right? But you start getting further into August, September, school starts getting back in. Now you have these kids in schools that weren't really, you know, they don't have HEPA air filters inside the school circulating system. They don't have, you know, especially in Grants Pass, we have some older schools, which don't necessarily have the best air ventilation systems. And so now you have these, right, to begin with. And now you put another, you know, the smoke with, you know, sometimes our air quality is, you know, poor or hazardous. And so, yeah, it definitely has an impact. And, you know, I can imagine as a firefighter, I'd spend a lot of time, you know, for instance, like in Happy Camp, or there's smoke in Happy Camp all year, it seems like. Especially all summer. And, you know, but kind of expect that it comes along with the territory. You're a firefighter, you're going to be in smoke. But now you're impacting entire communities of, you know, with kids and the elderly. From a fire department perspective, we do see an increase in our, you know, respiratory calls when there's heavy smoke, because there are people who are, you know, more susceptible to asthma and COPD and have effects from that.
Let me go back to something you just said about the firefighters, you know, expected to be in an area where they're breathing a lot of smoke. There's not a lot of occupations where you take a health hazard and just say, oh, well, that's just accepted, right? And, you know, you work in a hospital, you wear a film badge, and it measures how much radiation you're exposed to, and we set, you know, permissible levels for that. What's going on to protect firefighters? Because the idea that you should be, that you should just expect it to be exposed to something that's going to give you asthma or lung cancer or put heavy metals in your body, like, that's not something that we would accept in other industries. How much pushback are we seeing, you know, towards developing better breathing apparatus, you know, that are comfortable, that you could wear all day, but that don't require you to be subjected to breathing, you know, stuff you shouldn't put in your lungs?
Well, that's an interesting question. On the structural side, there's actually been a substantial amount of, I'd say, you know, not necessarily pushback, but a substantial amount of energy that's been put into cancer prevention, occupational health, you know, with, you know, recognizing that, you know, we should be wearing BAs on fires, that we need to cycle people out, having two sets of turnouts, so you're not wearing dirty turnouts, cleaning your gear, cleaning your hoods, cleaning the cabs, airing things out. Even as far as fire station design, with, you know, exhaust systems that, you know, to expel the exhaust from your bays,
right,
building bays where you don't have to walk through the bay to get, you know, to get to the living quarters or to get to the kitchen, on that side. I think in the wildland side, you've seen some small, I know there's been a lot of research that's been done on it and recognizing that, but and you've seen some small kind of like inroads on respiratory protection with, you know, some sorts of masks. I know that, like, you know, probably 10 plus years ago, we had something, I think they were called whiffs. Essentially, it was like a filter that you would wear.
Yeah.
I think the issue comes in you kind of already touched on it, was the duration of having to, you know, what you're having to do. An SCBA works great for short durations or areas where you have the accessibility to refill them.
When you're not pumping that thing up a 70 degree hill.
Exactly.
Right, but you look operating at machines burning 5,000 calories an hour with yeah.
Right, exactly.
Cool. It's right.
And when we were on Almeda, you know, there was a ton of homes burning, and I remember I saw several of the other structural agencies who had, you know, they had put their BAs on when they were around the house, and I was like, well, it's probably a really good idea. However, you have four bottles on your truck, you have four spares, so what happens when you run out? Like, it's you know, that's not a really good long-term solution. But with that being said, after the fact, several agencies actually did, you know, blood draws to check levels. Because I know when I left that, I coughed up black stuff for about a week afterwards, which I know was not good for me. Probably shaved some. And I've heard a lot of folks talk about that, that were on that incident. It was just the volume of stuff that we all coughed up afterwards because the homes that were burning carcinogens. So I do know there's a lot of research that's there, but it's coming up with a solution that's actually tenable for what you just mentioned. You know, I remember, you know, spending a week, you know, 2 weeks on end being spiked out on in the middle of a mountain, in the middle of nowhere, you know, having access to fresh air was, you know, not necessarily something you'd have, you know, be able to cycle out. And it's also not really reasonable to wear something that constricts your breathing
right
for that duration of time.
Right. You need a lightweight battery forced air filtration system, right? That, you know, that's a positive pressure system, that, you know, the ultimate CPAP machine or something, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. Something that has some positive pressure, but doesn't affect your, you know, like an SCBA, it's pretty restrictive of your breathing. You have
your vision, and you're sweating in it and all that. And
exactly. So yeah, you have to have something that's a little bit more user friendly for that duration.
Right. I think
it's $1 million idea if somebody comes up with something there and it's actually usable.
All right, I'll run some design ideas past you, and you tell me what's feasible. Because
that sounds perfect.
Right, it doesn't matter, right? It's like the bulletproof vests, right? It doesn't matter, you know, how big a bullet and fast a rifle round it can stop. If people won't wear it, it's not going to do any good. So you really have to have that user adoption, because it feels better to use it than not to use it.
Well, and I think on the structural side, we saw that change, right? In the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, like the people, BAs existed, but they were not user-friendly. They were big and bulky. And then there was a whole contingent of, you know, of the firefighting population who felt, oh, if you wear that, you're not X. You're not, you know, you're not cool. You're not
right.
You know, old school, whatever. But we've seen a complete shift in that. Over the years on the on the wildland side, I don't think we've seen, you know, the user adoption would be a huge lift there, making sure that it's adopted, utilized, and accepted as common practice.
Yeah.
It would be unusual for me to see somebody on a structure fire without a BA.
Right.
Now, but you know, 20 years ago, not so much.
Yeah, right. Maybe how old were you when you left the Forestry Service and moved over to fire department?
25.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And what, you know, was that like an average age of folks working forest fires with you?
Well, I'd say that, you know, I just speaking from my experience, I started when I was 18, as you know, yeah. I worked in Colorado for a couple of years as a seasonal, before going to California. I was hired as an apprentice, and you know, in my apprentice class, it was kind of, there were a lot of, you know, the varying age, but I'd say, you know, early 20s would be, was pretty common.
So the age of invincibility.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Fire's not going to get me. Smoke's not going to get me.
Well, and also it's a time where people are starting to figure out what their career is. This a career? Is this something I'm going to do for, you know, the long duration?
Right.
And I think for me, the, you know, the kind of the component that made me go towards fire departments, was really, I had a captain and he was, I think he was 52 when I worked with him. And so I was a permanent employee working on a, you know, hand crew. And I thought, I saw him one morning get up, and he'd been on shot crew since he was 18 years old. And I saw him get up in the morning, and you know, he took like 18 aspirin and 20 minutes of stretching to get moving. And I thought, man, this is gonna be really hard on my body long term. I don't know if I can do this for that long, or that I want to.
Right.
And so yeah, so that age of invincibility really came into play, where I was like recognizing, well, I don't know, maybe not. Maybe this isn't a good long term solution.
Yeah, probably. Younger people are going to be more influenced by seeing a young person impacted by the health benefits than seeing an older person, because they just take for, oh, well, he's old. Of course he's going to be hurting, blah, blah, blah. But that's not me, you know. But when they see a 25, 26-year-old hacking up a lung, they're like, oh, that could be me.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It kind of puts it in perspective. Now, I wouldn't have traded that time in the world. I enjoyed my time with the Forest Service. I got to fight fire in 18 states. Wow. You know, I worked in North Carolina on a shot crew, and we got to, you know, spent time in Florida and Virginia, Texas. So, gained a wealth of experience that has been, you know, advantageous to this day, for me, and been a really positive experience on my life, things I would have never got to see. And so it was really cool to do. But yeah, I think the long-term of that is that, you know, there has to be a lot of changes made in the agencies to attract younger folks to stay for the duration and figure out work life balances that are more effective for you know, folks wanting to stay for a career.
Right. Because I think people think about career, you know, as different benefits than an adventure. Right. You can go out and have the adventure. It's awesome. You know, and there's certain people who are, you know, geared towards that and really want that. And other people come to it more with a civil service mentality, and, you know, what are the benefits and what's the pay and what's the overtime structure and do I get a parking place and like that. Right.
So that's a great way to put it. I mean, a lot of folks I met, you know, in the Forest Service who they were there because they're, you know, they like skiing in the winter and they thought it was cool to, you know, work a summer job and then, you know, go see some stuff and then go skiing all winter. And then I met some folks who are, you know, more like, you know, mentioned like, I want to make an impact on the community. I want to be a part of a community. And so, yeah, you can really kind of bifurcate the folks who are drawn to that workforce. But yeah, long-term, you know, trying to determine what a career looks like, you know, obviously, you know, retirement, health benefits, and all those other things start coming into play. And, you know, it's been my experience and, you know, knowing a lot of other people who I still keep in touch with, that's something that impacts them all the time is, you know, looking across the aisle and seeing state or local agencies making substantially more with better life balances, better work duty locations. And what does that, you know, what does that look like for their personal lives
right.
long-term?
I want to ask you about those high elevation fires you were talking about that are, you know, more remote and maybe don't threaten communities by fire, but impact their quality of life by smoke. To what degree do you feel like we're seeing a shift towards structure and values at risk protection as a more of a focus and letting the natural fire ecology of remote areas restore itself with a more of a hands-off approach?
Well, over the last, I guess I can answer this by saying over the last, you know, I'd say 15 years or so, I remember I had a friend who worked on a wildland fire use module, which has been renamed since, but essentially their job was to go out there and, you know, fire that was away from the population, let it burn for natural resource benefit. And yeah. I remember there we had a fire on the Six Rivers that was, you know, a candidate for a fire use because it was far enough away from communities, it was kind of high elevation, and was burning in a previous fire scar. And so, like, you know, maybe we can let it burn. And we had some checkpoints and where we might try to corral it if it got to this area or did this, and some trigger points or decision making points. And it seems like that was had some momentum, but because of the smoke impacts, I remember that fire in particular. You know, Redding had a couple years of getting hit really hard with smoke. And so there's a lot of pushback from stakeholders on, you know, if you let that thing burn, that smoke is going to come directly into us, and we're not a big fan of that. So I think that that's had a quite a big impact on there, is trying to get the communities to understand that, you know, essentially fire is going to burn in those areas. There's,
yeah,
it's not a, whether it's fire or no fire. It's when the fire occurs and the duration of which we're going to allow it to. And so in Southern Oregon over the last few years, we've seen a lot of shift towards, you know, larger prescribed or broadcast burns in the fall and in the spring. And, you know, I've heard people complain about the smoke then, you know, oh, smoke already, we're already starting that. But I think the over the last few years, you've seen the shift in the community pushing back a little bit, saying, well, it's either now while they can control it,
yes,
and build the buffer, or it's going to be this, yes, summer when they can't control it and it's going to be here for weeks on end. And so you have seen a shift in the way that land management agencies are working with communities to try to be more proactive on that.
You know, I think it's really, or you correct me here, but I think that, that the buffer idea doesn't really pan out so much because the places where the prescribed burns are so remote that they're not actually acting as a physical buffer right around the community to provide, you know, an unburned or, you know, or a pre-burned swath of protection around the community. You know, only a very small percentage of the prescribed burns actually protect the community from fire. But one of the benefits that is being seen is a pre-smoke that, right,
yeah,
that if you can create, unfortunately, like long-term low-level smoke by doing remote prescribed burns, then you're reducing the likelihood that you're going to see like massive unbreathable air, because when the fire comes through, everything is burning.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the things,
right?
You know, that's one of the things I mean by buffer, is that it's buffering the smoke from potentially coming in. Is that,
I see,
let's,
yeah,
let's get out there now, treat it. I think that the priority though has always been in a lot of these fuels projects. I remember working on one in California where, you know, it was like, I want to say it was like 50 miles long, and it was essentially along a ridge line. And all 5 years I worked on there, we spent every, you know, day we weren't on fire on this fuels project. In the winter, burning the piles, limbing the trees in the summer, you know, stacking sticks, kind of going through that. The priority has always been on making those fuels projects closer to where the values at risk are.
Yeah.
And so I think it would be a huge shift for agencies to say, okay, instead of maybe putting them along the community, let's go out to the areas where they're, you know, higher deadened down, higher likelihood of that. You know, the fire that's going to burn prolonged happening. And I think that's also just comes down to, you know, cost, workforce availability. You know, if a project is 3 hours away from the community that they live in, how much work are you going to get done each day?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
And then, you know, nobody wants to be spiked out in the winter, all winter long, you know, in 20 degrees to stack sticks and, you know, limb trees. So, you know, it becomes a bit of a workforce issue and a timing problem to get those done.
Bring in the fire robots.
There's certainly, you know, I think we've seen, that's kind of an interesting, you know, piece, is that we've seen a lot of use towards equipment and some of those things, you know, especially heavy equipment like masticators, you know, out there doing there. But what you lose in that is that you have a lot of natural resource damage when you do those sorts of things. They tear, yeah, up trees pretty good. The soil gets impacted really heavily. I'm sure, you know, natural, you know, resource, animal habitat gets tore up. It doesn't have that, you know, human ability to say, oh, well, clearly there's something living in this tree. Let's dig a line around it so it doesn't burn.
Right.
And so, yeah, you may be able to get a higher volume of work done, but I think the quality of what you're able to get done is not quite there yet.
Well, I guess we'll see a balance on that. Brandon, I cannot,
yeah,
thank you enough for the insights you shared with us today. And I hope you'll come back and join me again on the Fire Break. This is Brandon Rigaud, Battalion Chief with Grants Pass Fire Rescue. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Hey, thanks, Steve.
Absolutely. We'll see. I know we're coming back to you soon because you've obviously got a lot more to share. All right, folks, you've been watching another, we're listening, depending on your preference for media intake. The Fire Break, we're sponsored by Team Wildfire, developing innovative new technologies and tactics for mitigating the worst dangers of wildfire. Thanks so much for joining me. We'll see you back on the next episode. Take care.